MFO Medford. Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there's no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. Good morning. It's the 29th of March, 2023, the day before baseball season opens up. But ironically, I'm not doing a baseball show this year. I'm going to start things off with episode 181 of Adventures in Research. This is Electronics and Transportation. This had an original air date of the 9th of July, 1946.
Adventures in Research.
Now you better climb again and...
Hey, pull her up, Joe. Here comes a piece of mountain.
It's okay, Mike. We missed it. Just missed it. Hey, Mike. Well, for gosh sake. The guy passed out cold.
This is Paul Shannon introducing another in the series of programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. Today's chapter by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories, is titled Electronics in Transportation. This is the story of men on the move and the electronic devices that guide them swiftly, safely on their way. It is the story of transportation and the remarkable part electronics has played in it. Far to the north, a great field of glacial ice shimmers in the crisp, cold air. The roaring of the wind, the hammering of the waves are dimmer beneath an ominous rumble that swells to a roar as it grows. Tons of blue-white ice, solid as Gibraltar's rock, are splitting away from the field to crash with a booming splash into the sea. An iceberg is born, a floating, ghost-like hulk. Most of its ponderous bulk submerged beneath the frigid water. Drifts out with the shifting tides, bearing south to the great Atlantic Ocean, south across the lanes of traffic to menace the precious hulls of cargo-carrying, life-bearing vessels. In packs, or just as often quite alone, the iceberg waits, a frozen, floating mountain, waits as she waited that April night in 1912 in the path of the new giant of the ocean, the steamship Titanic.
I think it is only proper, before we leave this fine salon, to thank our good friend, the purser, for arranging for us to use it. Indeed, we must certainly be duly grateful for so many things. The calm, lovely weather we've enjoyed. The smooth grace of this mammoth liner. It is fortunate that she has been so blessed on this, her maiden voyage across the sea. And we travel secure in the steadiness of her, in her strength. It is good to know that we sail on a ship that is unsinkable, safe from all.
Good evening, Captain Smith.
Mr. Lightoller, thought I'd look in on the bridge before I retire. All's well?
All's well, sir.
Lookout's been instructed to keep a sharp eye out for icebergs?
That he has, sir.
Well, we should be getting close to the section where they were reported to be.
With a smooth, oily sea like this, as this one running tonight, sir, they'll be hard to spot.
Yes, I know. Just as bad as running in a fog with icebergs to contend with.
The blasted things take on the same dark coloration as the sea. Well, just be sure to keep a sharp watch. Pass the word to Mr. Murdoch when he relieves you.
That I will, sir. He's due on at 4 bells. I'll be sure to speak to him about it.
Very well. Good night.
Good night, sir.
A calm, oily sea. A sky packed with stars. A night so clear, so black as to swallow up the icy monster lying ahead. And then from the crow's nest high above the bridge, that bell shattering the velvet night with a hammered warning, obstacle dead ahead.
Hitchin, starboard the helm, hard!
Starboard helm, sir!
First Officer Murdoch.
Crow's nest reporting. Iceberg, sir. You're going a little, but she's coming on fast.
Yes, yes, I can see it now.
We can't miss it, sir. She'll strike starboard, somewhere abaft the foremast.
Reports from below indicate things are bad, sir. She's ripped wide open, shipping water fast at the head. We didn't have a chance, Captain.
Have your officers give the alarm to all passengers. Order them on deck with life belts, but don't arouse their fears. I'm going to the Marconi room. We've got to get out a distress call at once.
Out across the lonely water went the mission of mercy, tense, loyal fingers pounding the shiny brass key. CQD, all stations attend, disaster. The Olympic, sister ship of the Titanic, heard the call and answered. But she was 560 miles away. The Baltic, 300 miles off, heard the call. So did the Parisienne and the Virginian, the Burma and the Mount Temple, and a German craft, the Frankfurt. 58 miles away from the tragic scene, the Carpathia heard the plea for help. And all began a race against time and the sea. But closest of all, the Californian, only 12 miles off, continued on her way. For wireless was something new, no standard life-saving requirement. And her operator was off duty for the night. The unsinkable Titanic plunged headlong to the bottom of the sea to take 1,000 lives along. And when the survivors landed at New York on the rescue ship Carpathia, Mark Coney, whose wireless made their rescue possible, was on the dock to greet them.
Yes, Mama. He was there on the dock when the Carpathia steamed in. I saw him myself. I saw the great Signor Marconi. Never in all my days of working on the docks have I gotten such a thrill. I can see it still in my mind. The survivors, as they pour down the gangway, they see him. They recognize him. They cry, "We owe our life to you." It's true, Mama. If it were not for Marconi's wireless, they would all be dead. Dead.
Man was not satisfied to travel on sea and land. The wings of the Wright brothers took him into the sky, gave him new speed, and new hazards, too. No icebergs up there to block his path.
But mountains have peaks, and they are high.
No waves to pound his craft or swamp it.
But air can be as rough, and currents as treacherous.
Closer to the stars by which a man can find his way.
Except for fog. And then, in those early days of flying, when airmail stamps were something new on envelopes, there was nothing, nothing at all to go by.
How you doing, Joe?
Not so good, Mike. Wish I hadn't started out on this trip. This fog doesn't look like it's going to break.
This is a bad place to get off course. Too many mountains. Better keep plenty altitude.
Yeah, I'm trying. Can't get above it. Can't see through it. Oh, if we just get a break.
How long has it been since you lost sight of the railroad?
About 15 minutes. Hey, wait. There's a break in the fog. Let's make for it. No use, Mike. All I saw was a lot of nothing. Now we're in the soup again, and we've lost altitude.
Oh, you better climb it. Hey, pull her up, Joe. Here comes a piece of mountain.
It's okay, Mike. We were lucky. Just missed it. Well, don't worry. I know where that mountain belongs now, and I'll stay above it till it clears. Hey, Mike. Well, for gosh sake, the guy passed out. Cold.
That's how it was. Give one of those pilots a landmark, and he was all right. Just as long as he could look below and see a river or a brightly painted barn or two,
or a railroad track or a high mountain he was far enough away from. Today, though, it's different. Look into the pilot's compartment of a huge, modern luxury liner of the air. While the passengers relax in comfort and safety, safety made possible by electronics, the pilot sits there, radio phones clamped to his ears, watching dials and instruments and panel lights, and listening.
Chicago Control calling Flight 407. Come in, please.
Flight 407 to Chicago Control. Go ahead.
Ceiling here is zero. Repeat, zero. Do not attempt landing. Proceed along north leg of range to Detroit Control. Weather at Detroit lifting. Go ahead.
Flight 407 to Chicago Control. Position 7214. Altitude is 7,000.
High up there in the foggy night, the pilot gets his instructions by radio. Hears in his headphones the continuous hum of the radio beam and rides the roadway it paves for him through the sky. A roadway broadcast from ground stations dotted all along his route. Transmitters directing a beam of radio waves that marks his course through blinding fog no light could penetrate. And when he says to his co-pilot,
check the compass, Tom, and let's take a fix.
That means turn on the radio compass and find out our exact position up here in this murky sky. A special antenna on the plane revolves, picks out a radio station at a known spot, and the compass, there on the instrument panel, connected to the turning antenna, points straight to the station. The co-pilot tunes in another station. The compass points it out. Then by drawing lines on a map from those two compass points to the place where the lines cross, the co-pilot gets his exact position.
Got it. We're right on the nose. Should be in touch with Detroit Radio Tower in 15 minutes.
And out of the foggy night that blankets the airport, your sleek, wet transport follows a radio beam to the firm safety of the concrete runway. Radio is the seeing eye of the airways. Electronic devices are serving the rails, too, putting the block signals right in the cab with the engineer. Someday, they may automatically warn of obstacles ahead, even stop the train mechanically to avoid collisions. Traffic signals for your car may come right into the dashboard by electronics. And this... a car crash on the highway may be history when radar gets to work on our autos. Radar, an important development of World War II.
Radar swept the skies above England and stopped the German Luftwaffe in its tracks. That was in 1940 and 1941.
Radar works on the principle of reflection. Put a mirror in the path of a ray of light, and it will send the ray back where it came from. Send out the proper kind of a radio wave, concentrated in a beam, let it strike an object in its path, and the object will reflect the radio beam back where it came from. Complicated?
Heinrich Hertz knew radio waves could be reflected as long ago as 1886. Marconi knew it in 1922.
Yes, but it took a lot of men and a lot of research to make it what it is today. If only we could have known in 1912 what we know now. Can't you just see the giant Titanic on her maiden voyage, no longer blind to the lurking icebergs?
Good evening, Captain Smith.
Mr. Lightoller. Thought I'd look in on the bridge before I retire. All's well?
All's well, sir. There's the iceberg picture on the radar scope, Captain. The warnings were right enough.
Well, looks like quite a field of them.
This one here is the nearest to us. Looks like it's right on our course.
It does at that. Better alter your course a little. Just a little. And keep an eye on the scope. Check the course with the radio loop and have Sparks confirm that iceberg report by radio. Well, you won't be needing me for anything more, Mr. Lightoller. Think I'll turn in.
Right, sir. Good night, sir.
Good night.
we heard Adventures in Research. We're going to bookend the next program, the feature program, with another Adventures in Research coming up in the last quarter of the hour. My name is Arthur, and you're listening to 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. The Clock is the next program. I think I might have played one Clock maybe a year and a half ago. This one was written by the great Lucille Fletcher. I guess give a nod to her and her accolades, radio accolades here for the Women's History Month. This one's titled Bad Dreams. Had an original air date of the 25th of April, 1948. Thanks for listening.
In just a moment, you will hear The Clock, presenting transcribed the premiere of a new thrill drama by Lucille Fletcher, the author of Sorry Wrong Number and other noted studies in suspense. Listen now to
The Clock.
The American Broadcasting Company presents another in a series of dramatic programs, The Clock. From Hollywood, The Clock tonight stars two distinguished players, Elliot Lewis and Jeanette Nolan, and is produced and directed by radio's master of the art of suspense, William Spear.
And fulfillment, birth and death. The whole drama of life is written in the sands of time. Clocks. All over the city, clocks. Little clocks and big ones, new ones just learning to count. Old ones hold hands at the game. Clocks standing aloof from their owners, taking no part in their joys or sorrows. Their faces immutable, impervious. All over the city, the clocking needles, sewing the fabric of life, and the death which must make room for new life. Stitching time, the clock, whose face shows no anger or delight or surprise. Because time sees all things. From the two-room walk-up flat on the lower Third Avenue, New York, where Mr. and Mrs. Bela Bozniak live over a second-hand clothing store, you can hear, if the Third Avenue elevator isn't going by, the chimes of the huge clock atop the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company building.
Good morning, Charlotte. I'm so sorry to be so late, but I overslept myself. I was dreaming.
Breakfast is over 2 hours ago. Everything is put away.
So, of course. But perhaps there's some coffee.
I don't keep stale coffee standing around all day. If you want, you can make some for yourself.
Thank you, Charlotte. Such a dream I had. Does my head ache? Do I feel depressed? Is there by any chance a piece of coffee cake in the house?
No. Uncle Miklosh came by this morning.
Uncle Miklosh? What do you want?
He wants you to come down and make fresh potato salad. The boy from the high school didn't come.
But I thought it was my day off. All right, Charlotte, I will go. Just as soon as I have my coffee. Oh, what a dream. What a terrible dream. I cannot seem to get it out of my head. Do you know what I was dreaming, Charlotte?
Who cares?
I dreamed I was being electrocuted. Electrocuted, Charlotte. Isn't that terrible?
The water's boiling.
And it was so real, too. I was in a cell, a real cell in a prison. White, glaring white, like a bathroom. I was lying on a cot with my hands behind my head when suddenly I heard these footsteps outside the door. Then I jumped up like a madman. And it came over me that the footsteps were my jailers. They were coming for me, to kill me. I was condemned to die.
Will you hurry? Drink your coffee. I told him you'd be right
down. Yeah, but the coffee's so hot. There's a cup for you, Joe.
No.
And then these guards came into my cell and dragged me from the bars. There were four guards in gray uniforms. There was also a tin priest. Now, everything was very quiet. All the other prisoners shut up. They watched me from behind their cell doors. I could feel their eyes burning at me. I could hear my feet shuffle, shuffle along the floor. I felt so weak.
No, you don't. Have another cup. Give me that pot.
But it would help clear my head a little. After a dream like that.
Get your clothes on. That will clear your head.
In a minute. I'm just trying to remember.
Remember what?
Why they were electrocuting me. What I had done.
Oh, what an idiot. He worries about his dream.
Yeah. I suppose it's silly. But that is the trouble with dreams. They tell you one little thing, and it is so real. But the rest of the story, they keep it to themselves.
But are you going to stand around here talking all day?
No, I was just going. I'll be right down. Charlotte? I don't want to disturb you, Charlotte.
You can't come in. I'm scrubbing this kitchen, and I don't want you making tracks across my floor.
I know, Charlotte. I wouldn't want to mark your nice, clean floor. It's only my coffee.
Go down to the drugstore for your coffee.
It's closed on Sundays.
So? I told you when we were having breakfast.
I know, but 8 o'clock. It's such an early hour for Sunday. And Uncle Miklos kept the store open last night till 11.
You didn't come home last night at 11.
A little glass of beer at Kleinman's. Would you begrudge me that after I was on my feet till 11 o'clock at night? Please, Charlotte. I don't feel so good this morning, either.
Naturally, after Kleinman.
I'm not sleeping so good. Not all week. I'm having the same bad dream.
Yeah, always some excuse.
But it's true. Do you remember? I told you I dreamed I was electrocuted. I was in that cell. Well, every night now, for a week, I have been dreaming about that cell.
So what?
And in one corner, there's a bed. Two magazines, the Look magazine and the Hungarian Weekly. I can see them just as clear as if they were in this kitchen.
Well, move those chairs out of the way. I want to scrub under the table.
Don't you think that's very clear, Charlotte?
What's clear?
To dream all that. Every night.
Who cares about dreams? They're all the junk in your head.
But it is very clear, just the same, to be there night after night. Oh, yes. Last night, Uncle Miklos was there, too.
Huh? What?
I mean, in the dream. He came to see me in my cell. Wasn't that queer?
I don't see anything so queer about that.
Can you imagine Uncle Miklos giving me anything?
That's a fine thing to say. Who brought you to America? Who gave you the job in the delicatessen?
I didn't mean that way, Charlotte. I meant...
What did you mean?
I meant... Well, Uncle Miklos is always so careful with food in the delicatessen. But in the dream, it was a very nice roast chicken in the dream. With plenty of breast and stuffing. And Uncle Miklos even had a bottle opener in his basket to open up the schnapps. He kept telling me to eat. Eat! Eat, Bella! He kept saying. Stuff yourself! I can hear how he said it. You only got another month to live. Maybe I should go to see a doctor. He should give me a thorough checkup.
Maybe you should go to a fortune teller, too. Lots of places will be glad to take your money. If you only got the money.
Might be a good idea.
Only you don't got the money.
But, Charlotte...
Will you keep your dirty feet off my nice clean floor?
I'm sorry, Charlotte. I'll wipe it off.
Oh, get out, will you? Go down to the drugstore and get you some coffee.
Thank you.
you sleeping here for by the radio in the middle of the afternoon yet?
Well, what time is it?
4 o'clock. Why aren't you in the store?
I just came up here for a nap.
A nap? In the middle of the day? Where is Uncle Miklos?
Uncle Miklos went out. There was no customers. I was very tired. But if it is 4 o'clock, Uncle Miklos was coming back at 3.
So, Uncle Miklos was coming back at 3? Now you're in a fine mess, a fine, nice mess.
Well, maybe he's not back yet.
Hey, and what's this bottle of beer doing under the sofa?
What bottle of beer?
So, that's why you were so tired. Why you didn't hear me. Why the radio was playing so loud I could hear it halfway down the street. Drunk.
Oh, please, Charlotte. It was so hot. And I wasn't really drunk. I was only asleep. I was having a terrible nightmare.
Where did you get this bottle? From Kleinman's? Or from Uncle Miklos' store?
From the store. But I will pay him back, Charlotte. Now listen to my heart. How it's still pounding. How can a man wake up quickly when he's dreaming he's on trial for his life? Think of it. 1,000 people looking at you, and the judge with his black cap on, and the jury standing there, and then one of them getting up and pointing. And you hear the words, clear, clear. Guilty. Bela Bozniak is guilty and is condemned to death.
How many times do I have to tell you never to touch anything in that store that belongs to Uncle Miklos?
Charlotte, why should they say I am guilty?
Because you are. You are guilty of stealing Uncle Miklos' bottle of beer and cheating on your time in that store. Naps yet. Naps! Like a millionaire! And how do I know what other things you are guilty of? Maybe you steal from the cash register. Who knows? Maybe you stuff yourself full of blutwurst and pickles when Uncle Miklos is not looking. Maybe you insult the
Charlotte.
Customers.
What a terrible thing to say.
I know what I hear from Uncle Miklos.
What do you hear from Uncle Miklos?
Lots of things. But all I got to say to you, Bela Bozniak, is you better watch your step from now on. You better behave yourself.
What? Why? No use, Charlotte. No use. I got to see a doctor or something.
Oh, get out of that bed, lazy good-for-nothing.
Charlotte, I'm really sick. I must have a growth in my brain.
Yeah, there's always something the matter with you when it comes time
Nobody
to work.
Nobody keeps on dreaming the same dream night after night. Nobody. With a normal mind in his head.
Keep quiet. I don't want to hear about your dreams.
Always, I got this terrible guilt in me. Like a pain. All night long. I'm running away. I'm hiding from people who are trying to catch me.
So why do you run? Why don't you get caught?
I am on the streetcar, riding under the L down Third Avenue. There are lots of people. I'm squeezing myself tight up against the window, turning my face out so no one will recognize me. I am pulling my coat collar up around my face and my cap down over my eyes. I am wearing dark glasses. I am running along the Lightstone Bridge. It's summer, a bright, flaring day. I am like a little black speck on the big steel bridge. And over my head, they are looking at me from airplanes. And under the bridge, they are watching me from boats. The automobiles are racing after me, honking their horns. Far, far ahead, at the end of the bridge, I see the man at the toll gate, waiting to stop me. He's a tall man with glasses, a brown overcoat, bald. His name is Mr. Turner. Please, Charlotte, don't do that.
Maybe if the covers are off you, you will shut your mouth and get out of that bed.
I can't. I'm too weak.
Lazy, good for nothing. Get up!
Over to the doctor.
So, you were over to the doctor. I wish you joy to the doctors. And what did the doctor do for you, millionaire?
Nothing.
Nothing. $3 he pays to the doctor for a visit, and the doctor does nothing for him. Wonderful.
Dr. Stumpfold was not a mind doctor. It's for the stomach and the heart. Knows nothing about the brain.
Oh, so now he figures that out. Dr. Stumpfogel is not a mind doctor. Now, after he throws away the $3.
He gave me these pills.
Yeah, medicine already. How much do they cost?
They are sleeping pills. I don't need sleeping pills. I don't want to go to sleep.
So in this case, then, why did you buy them?
I am afraid to sleep. Every time I sleep, there is that Mr. Toyner waiting for me again. He is everywhere. Beside the ashcans in the air shaft, on the fire escape, in the hallway behind the baby carriages. I even dream he's in the delicatessen. He's looking over the counter at me like a customer. He's hiding behind the herring barrels.
Hey, give me those pills. You didn't take any yet, did you?
He's even in Kleinman's. He's sitting there in the back room drinking a glass of beer and looking out the plate glass for me to go by. His face is green and red in the neon sign going on and off outside. Now green, now red. And sometimes I hear him whispering.
That's good. It isn't a special prescription. I can take that back to the drugstore. You didn't even open the bottle.
He whispers to somebody about me. He tells people what I have done. And I know it's true. I am guilty. Oh, how I am guilty.
I'll go take that back to the drugstore right now.
But why am I guilty? What have I done? Charlotte, think. How could I be guilty? Is it because of Mama? That I left her there hungry and never brought her over like I promised. But you yourself, Charlotte, said there was no room. And the money Uncle Miklos paid me. How could I have brought Mama here to starve? How could I have paid a boat trip when there was nothing for us half the time to pay the rent? But maybe it is Mama cursing me from the grave. Charlotte! Charlotte! Don't leave me alone, please.
Charlotte. Hello, Charlotte. I got good news for you, Charlotte. At last, I just slept.
Huh.
And the dreams, the bad dreams, have gone away. 2 hours, 3 hours, I was sleeping, and there was nothing, just sleep. Isn't that wonderful, Charlotte? I guess I'm cured, eh? You went out and left me alone. I was so tired. But I was afraid to sleep. I went to the park and I lay down on a bench. But the minute I closed my eyes, there was that Mr. Turner again with his face green and red. And then I went over to Kleinman's. I had only 2 little beers. The pianola was playing. It was nice and cool and dark.
Oh, my God,
Charlotte! Charlotte! What is it? Please, Charlotte! You're not that mad at me, are you?
Oh, you numbskull! You good-for-nothing shillelagh!
So, Charlotte, please, what has happened?
What has happened? You are fired, that is what has happened. Uncle Miklos refuses to put up with you anymore.
What?
He's through with you, do you hear? Through! There is a boy, a high school boy, working in your place full time.
No, you mean making the potato salad too?
Yes, making the potato salad too. And waiting on the customers. Now loafing on the sidewalk and taking naps and talking like a lunatic. And getting drunk every other night. And now what are you going to do? What are you going to do?
I will go down and speak to Uncle Miklos.
Ah, he will go speak to Uncle Miklos at 2 o'clock in the morning. Yet he will speak to Uncle Miklos and get thrown out on his ear and go to the hospital and cause more expense.
Uncle Miklos, he will get over it, Charlotte.
Yes, that's what you think. You haven't talked to Uncle Miklos yet.
But Charlotte...
2 days. 2 days! Yes, Uncle Miklos couldn't go to Hoboken to see about the cheesecake. You were lying homesick in bed. With what? With the fever, with the stomach trouble, with the bad leg? No! With dreams! Bad dreams, yes, like a
Charlotte.
And where are you? When the customers are telephoning for the orders, they should be sent up right away. Upstairs, sleeping, taking a nap. And where are you Friday night, the busiest night in the store? Seeing Dr. Stumphogel throwing out your good money to a crack. And where are you today, when Uncle Miklos is going to play in the Interbrox Hungarian Checkers Tournament?
Checkers Tournament today?
Yes!
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot.
Drunk, sleeping, in Kleinman's back room. Oh,
never. I wouldn't stay away on purpose, Charlotte.
Yeah, that's all the thanks Uncle Miklos gets. After all he's done for you. I don't blame him. He gave you plenty of rope you should hang yourself with. He closed his eyes to plenty.
I'll apologize. I'll explain to him everything in the morning. He's not unreasonable. After all, he's your uncle, Charlotte.
Too bad for him.
He wouldn't let us starve, Charlotte. Uncle Miklos couldn't.
So, it's 9 o'clock. How much longer are you going to wait to go down and speak to Uncle Miklos?
In a minute. I'm going right away. I just got to pull myself together a little.
Yeah, I thought so. You don't talk so brave this morning, do you?
It's not that. It's just, I'm sick. I got those same bad dreams back all over again.
Sure, you got them. Whenever you got something to do you don't want to do, back they come. Wonderful.
No, Charlie. I'm not afraid of Uncle Miklos now. I am afraid of myself.
But don't think I'm such a sucker, Bella. I've listened to you complaining long enough. I don't fall for that same tune forever.
Listen, Charlotte, listen to me just for once. Job can wait a few minutes.
Oh, the job can wait, can that? That's a new one, the job can wait.
I have done something. Maybe I did it in my sleep. Maybe I'm a sleepwalker. Maybe I climbed down the fire escape sometime and went into somebody's kitchen somewhere and committed a murder. I couldn't dream such things all by myself. Last night, I dreamed I'd just killed somebody. It had just made 2 o'clock. I was coming out of a window, climbing out over the sill. It was night. There was a fire escape with flower pots going down into an air shaft. I started to climb down. It was a long way to the ground. I crept down like a monkey. And as I went, I could see into all the dark windows of the flats. A man was eating his supper, and his radio was playing, and a baby was crying. And all the time, I kept holding my breath, afraid they would see me. Because upstairs, there was somebody lying in a room. White, like a kitchen. Dead. That I had killed.
Shut up! Lunatic! Shut up with that nonsense. Or I'll clap you in the crazy house right now. Now, get downstairs, Uncle Miklos, and get that job back. You hear? Do you hear me, Bella? Did you hear what I said? Look at you, shaking like a leaf. You're an old man already. You're not afraid of Uncle Miklos, not much. You're afraid of everything. Afraid of your own shadow, your own crazy dreams. A fine man I throw myself away on. A fine hero. Yeah. What are you looking at me that way for? You don't think I can hit you, huh? You think I'm going to stand around here forever wasting my time on a good-for-nothing? You think I'm good only to wash your clothes and keep your house clean? You think I got no strength in my hands? I can hurt you worse than that sometime. Much worse. You get your life. Bless What are you standing there for, then? Are you going down now? Or not?
I am going, Charlotte. I'm going.
At this time of night? Making sandwiches? There's no bread for sandwiches. What are you doing with that knife?
I was just dreaming. We had another strange dream, Charlotte.
Get into bed. Put that knife back into the drawer.
I was dreaming. I was washing my hands, Charlotte. Over there, in that sink.
So, what?
And they were covered with blood. I was washing this knife, too. It was covered with blood, too.
Yeah, and what's so strange about that?
It was your blood, Charlotte.
My blood?
Yeah.
Transcribed from Hollywood, The Clock is produced and directed by William Spear, the master of suspense. And tonight starred Jeanette Nolan and Elliot Lewis. This evening's play was written by Lucille Fletcher. The Clock theme was composed by Bernie Green. Our musical director is Basil Adlam. Next week, same time, you will hear Kathy and Elliot Lewis as stars of...
The Clock.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Thank you, Ad Council, for that FCC obligation. We heard The Clock, Bad Dreams. There's nothing like a little murder there before 6 a.m., is there? I had an original air date of the 25th of April, 1948. And as promised and as anticipated, I'm going to conclude this segment of the Grand Hour with an Adventures in Research. Yeah, my name is Arthur, and you're listening to 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Adventures in Research, Electronics and Communications. This is actually episode 180. We started the show off with 181. I thought Electronics and Communications might be a little bit more interesting than transportation. Thanks for listening.
Adventures in Research.
I tell you, I saw it with my own eyes. He sent a message from one room to another by wire.
X-ray, X-ray, read all about it. Message sent across ocean without any wires. X-ray, read all about it.
What has gone wrong?
This is Paul Shannon introducing another in the series of programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. Our story today by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories, is called Electronics in Communication. This is the story of man's invisible messengers, the electrons, and how they were harnessed to carry his words throughout the world. It is more than the story of electrical communication. It is a tribute to the progress made by civilization. Jungle drums thumping through the thick, dank air of the tropics. Indian drums throbbing through the oak-lined woods of the Western world. Voices in the night. Hammering news of a celebration, warfare, warning. And then another beat, the rhythmic pounding of horses' hooves on the hard-packed road to Lexington and Concord.
To arms! To arms! The British are coming! To arms! To arms! The British are coming!
Westward moves America, fighting, struggling, pushing its frontiers farther into the heart of the new world, lengthening the distance over which man's words must go. It is the year 1825. In a house in New Haven, Connecticut, a young woman lies ill, gravely ill. The physician at her bedside wears a troubled look on his face as he speaks softly to the other woman in the room.
Don't know. It looks pretty hopeless. She's taken a bad turn.
Oh, doctor, is there nothing you can do?
I'm afraid not. I think it best to notify her husband as quickly as possible.
But can we get the message to him in time before she goes, doctor?
Now, we can try, and that is all. I'll see if I can get an urgent message through to Washington on the boat that leaves here this afternoon. And the postmaster may know of a courier riding overland, too.
But I'll try, doctor. Please do. He'd want to see her so badly before...
There. There. I shall utilize every effort at my command.
Excuse me, Mr. Moore, sir. I hate to disturb your painting, but a letter just came for you from New Haven, marked urgent.
Oh, thank you. I'll take it. Urgent, eh? Now, what could that be? Wait just a minute, please.
No. Is something wrong?
Yes. Yes, it's very serious. I shall have to leave at once. Immediately. Oh, yes, please tell Monsieur Lafayette I shall be unable to finish his portrait. Do that, please. I must pack immediately. Doctor, how is she? I got your message a week after you wrote it. I came as quickly as I could. Is she gone?
Now, Sam, you must get hold of yourself. We did everything we could to get word to you in time, but it just...
And the funeral?
Last week, Sam. Just last week.
That man was Samuel F. B. Morse, one of America's foremost painters. This tragedy taught him the need for rapid communication. He never forgot it. Morse continued his artwork, traveled to Europe to study and to paint. It was October the 6th, 1832, aboard the packet ship Sully, bound for America, when the answer to the question of rapid communication came to this painter with a scientific turn of mind. He was having dinner in the ship's salon with an interesting group, including Dr. Charles Jackson, a resident of Boston.
Yes, gentlemen, this man Henry has hit upon something quite unique, to say the least.
Electromagnetism, you say, Dr. Jackson?
Yes, Mr. Morse. But I'm surprised to find a painter interested in these scientific things.
Not so surprising, Doctor. I've attended many an interesting lecture on electricity.
Amazing. Then you'll understand, no doubt, that what Henry has done is to bend a piece of iron in the shape of a horseshoe and wind it with wire. Then he sends an electric current through the wire, and the iron magnet will pick up another small bar of iron. Electricity travels instantly through the entire length of wire, you see, and thus causes the magnet to act.
I see. Tell me, Doctor, could electricity be made to go over many miles of wire almost instantaneously?
Yes. Yes, it could.
If electricity is present in every part of the circuit, I see no reason why messages may not be sent instantly by electricity. You'll excuse me, gentlemen, please. I have some very important thinking to do. Some very important thinking.
Well, how odd. How extremely odd.
Transmit messages by electricity over miles of wire.
Doctor, I got your message a week after you wrote it.
The iron bar becomes a magnet which will attract another iron bar.
We did everything we could to get word to you in time.
Each time the electricity travels through the... That's it. That's it. Telegraph. Writing at a distance.
The first telegraph instrument to send and receive, built by Samuel Morse in his rooms at the College of the City of New York. Length of wire for transmission, 1,700 feet. 1838, now assisted by a young graduate of the university, Alfred Vail, an improved instrument to send and receive. Length of wire for transmission, stretched around a Morristown, New Jersey factory, 3 miles. And the telegraph clicked away, if only in the hearts of Samuel Morse and his assistant, Alfred Vail. Without funds, against stubborn popular opinion, they kept up their long fight for recognition. Finally, in 1843, a bill was introduced in Congress.
Mr. Morse!
Just a minute. Well, Annie Ellsworth, come in.
Thank you, Mr. Morse. I can't stay but a moment. Have you heard the news?
The news?
But of course, Father just got word at his office.
It's about the bill.
Yes, it passed Congress. President Tyler has signed it. And the appropriation is for $30,000 for a telegraph line from Washington to Baltimore. Isn't it wonderful?
Annie, this is the best news I've heard in a long, long time. And you shall have the honor of composing the first telegram.
And on May 24, 1844, in the Supreme Court Chamber at Washington, in the presence of some of the nation's most prominent figures, Annie Ellsworth's message was written into communication history. Carried on the wings of electricity over 40 miles of wire from Baltimore to Washington came the meaningful biblical quotation, "What hath God wrought?" Then, in 1876, in the attic of a Boston house, a strange contraption is built by a man named Alexander Graham Bell and his aide, Thomas Watson. This attic has been their laboratory, where they have worked long, tiring hours to develop an improved communication system. Now, Alexander Bell exclaims,
Mr. Watson, come here, I want you.
And in a room adjoining, Watson is surprised to hear,
Mr. Watson, come here. I want you.
Mr. Bell, I can't hear you. I can hear the words.
The wires are talking now, carrying the voice with the speed of light, 186,000 miles a second throughout the world. Now across the ocean, a young man named Marconi, the son of a wealthy Italian gentleman, is thinking of the scientific experiments of Heinrich Wilhelm Hertz.
Hertz, huh? So he has proved Maxwell's theory of electromagnetic waves. Invisible waves can be handled like polarized light waves. Radiation, eh? If the radiation could only be increased, developed, and controlled, it ought to be possible to signal across space for considerable distance. Yes.
Marconi set to work immediately, determined to accomplish his aim. Wireless communication. From the scientific pioneers of an earlier day, he took the induction coil, the Righi gap, the telegraph key, the batteries, and a receiving device known as a coherer. Wiring them together, he put them to work.
Alfonso, there it is. We've sent a signal and received it through the air just as I visioned it. No wires, no space, only space. Here, come over to my side of the table, and you send a signal.
From one side of a table to the other, wireless. From one room to another, wireless. Across the channel, Great Britain to France, wireless. December 1901, the first wireless signal links two continents. By 1909, regular commercial service across the ocean was a reality. And in that same year, aboard a ship in the Atlantic, a man new at his job, the radio man, hears in his receiving set...
Distress call! Liner SS Republic in distress off Sandy Hook!
First distress call for help by radio, CQD, later changed to SOS. That call saved hundreds of lives in what would otherwise have been another tragedy of the sea. Wireless had already won its laurels. Now come the Fleming valve to improve radio reception, the DeForest grid tube to amplify, to generate radio waves, to modulate the waves with voices. Throughout the world, amateurs experiment with wires and coils and tubes, with dials, antennas, and crystals.
Hey, Pop, what you doing?
You know what I'm doing, so don't ask. I'm trying to get this crystal set of mine to working.
Can you hear anything when you put those earphones to your ear?
Sure.
What?
Static. Now, go away and play somewhere else. You're making me nervous.
What are you supposed to hear in the earphones, Dad?
Well, Frank Conrad said he was going to tell us on this radio how the election came out today. Well, I'm figuring Harding to beat Cox for president. It's about time they should be saying something. Can't hear a thing so far.
Who's Frank Conrad, Dad?
He's a scientist at Westinghouse. Now, be quiet for a minute or two, son. Hey, this is all right. Hey, come here, son. Hey, your father's a real radio man. Listen to this.
This is Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We have the first returns in the Harding and Cox elections. Just a minute, please. We'll have them for you.
Gosh, Pop, that's radio, isn't it?
Yes, that's radio. November 1920. Out of that first election broadcast by KDKA grew the special features broadcast over hundreds of stations today. Out of the dreams of men like Morse and Bell and Hertz and Marconi and a host of other adventurers in research came the reality of rapid communication. Out of man's struggle with the unknown came words on the wings of electronic energy, swifter than sound, as fast as light.
Our hearts are free, so tell me what's wrong with you.